What's up, Gator Nation?
Good morning, Gator Nation.
You're listening to Gator Nation.
And the Gators have the biggest lead of the day.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WUMT.
From the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communication.
3, 2, 1, we're live.
Hi, everyone. This is The Communicator, the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications podcast, where we dive into the latest in media, picking the brains of top faculty and staff around the Gator Nation. I'm Matthew Abramson, Director of Media Services with Donovan Gast.
Hey there.
And Paola Perez.
Hey.
Today we're speaking with Houston Wells, lecturer in the Department of Media Production, Management, and Technology. Thanks for joining us, Houston.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So, thrilled to be here. I'm going to talk over everything you do.
Excellent.
Get used to it. These guys know.
No, yeah. We're thrilled.
Uh-huh.
We're more thrilled. Houston, you earned your bachelor's degree in zoology from UF. What were your career goals at the time? Why is it pronounced zoology? And does your background still come into play working with all the crazy animals here at the CJC?
Well, I guess let's deal with the most important part of that about the pronunciation. If it were zoology, that would be like three O's in a row, right? Because ology is the study of, and that would be the zoos. So that's why I think that's why they call it zoo science, like if you take it at the Santa Fe Zoo or whatever.
Interesting.
I call it science.
Nice. I can't reach the effects board, but I'll just reference it. I thought that perhaps I wanted to go into veterinary medicine, and went and worked at a vet clinic for several years in undergrad, and realized actually I still loved it, but I don't think I didn't want to do it for a career. I started as a zoology major, and then I was an animal science major in the College of Agriculture for a little while, and then bounced back to zoology when I realized I didn't want to do veterinary school, and ended up getting a master's degree in secondary science education. So I went off and became a high school biology teacher for several years. And, speaking of working with animals, wah, wah. I don't need the soundboard. Are you kidding? I do my own effects here. More questions. I love talking about me.
What inspired your graduate degree?
Which one?
Oh boy. The master's in education.
How's that for a flex?
What inspired you to go back for your master's degree in education?
I had a zoology degree and I needed to do something with it. No, I actually have spent my entire life enjoying being a student. I had many teachers growing up that were inspirational to me, middle school, high school, college, and saw that as an opportunity to, I hate to be like give back to the community, but it did feel, I mean, it's a certain, you know, there's a service element involved with that. And so that felt like the right thing to do at the time. And so I pursued that master's degree in education, went and taught high school down near Orlando for several years. And more questions.
And what were you teaching in high school?
Oh, okay. So I was a biology teacher and a marine biology teacher. Very different from what I do now, except what's funny is that even though the subject matter is different, teaching is, I mean, there's so much in that Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlap there as far as like just working with students. And we like to pretend that something magical happens between the time that you're 18 and a senior in high school and when you're 18 and a half and you're a freshman in college. But we're all just humans. We learn in similar ways. I mean, similarly different ways, but a lot of the skills that you get that you practice as a high school teacher or something like that also can apply at a college or even postgraduate level, I think.
So Donovan cutting in here again, for those of our listeners who don't know, back in the day, the CJC had a documentary institute. Can you tell us about your experience with that program and some of the projects you worked on?
Sure. When I was teaching at the high school, there was somebody that was teaching a television production class, a video production class. And I was like, that looks like fun. I would like to be able to do that. And I had a little background in video work and mostly just an interest in it. And so I was kind of studying my options going, are there some classes I can take at like the local, you know, community college or something that I feel like would qualify me to be able to turn around and go to, say, the principal and say, I would like to teach a course on video production. And in looking into finding some classes like that, I discovered there was this program, a new program at the time at the CJC called the Documentary Institute. And I thought to myself, well, there's no way I would possibly get accepted into a master's level documentary production program, I have no background in it. And I reached out to them and they said, actually, you're exactly the kind of person that would fit in here because we want people with varied backgrounds and, you know, curiosity and things like that. So I put in my letter of resignation at the high school. I didn't just quit on the spot. As many times as you feel like doing that, I was like, at the end of this year, I'm going to move on. And then came to the university and my wife and I lived like starving students again, which when you're teaching high school, you live like a starving student anyway. So it wasn't that big of a shift. But we moved back to Gainesville and I started that program.
And so what kind of projects did you do in that program?
So we did a lot of short projects, sort of, you know, just practicing the skills. Because again, most of us were coming into that program. I think I had a cohort of maybe 10 or 11 other students. We didn't have technical background. So we were learning about like white balancing and, you know, stuff like that. But the big project that I ended up working on, a team of three of us, was about historical tourism in Charleston, South Carolina, and the fact that it's really it was playful, but it also kind of asked some big questions about like the commodification of culture and some fascinating ideas, like if you put up a statue to memorialize something, does that sort of give you as a community permission to forget that thing? Because it's almost like you've checked a box of respecting it or remembering it. And then what about the people that have lived there, you know, generationally, people that have lived in old Charleston for, you know, their grandparents lived there. And now you've got, you know, tour buses and things parking in their street and everything. So questions about that.
Excellent. In 2002, you began working for the Digital Lighthouse Productions based in Gainesville.
So, and you guys, where have you been digging up this information? Where did you scour the internet to find this?
Everywhere. Used to live right around the corner.
That's true.
Okay. Yeah,
right by Eagles. I asked Mrs. Wells.
I played disc golf right by there. So Digital Lighthouse Productions, what types of projects were you involved in? Tell us about the team there.
Sure. So actually that came about through my association with the Documentary Institute, because the owner and founder of Digital Lighthouse Productions is a friend of mine, Dan Spies, and he was editing. Actually, he edited a couple of the documentaries that the Documentary Institute faculty were creating. They were working on creative work as well as teaching. And I was like, I would like to go meet this person that is your editor, and kind of showed up on his doorstep one time, sort of half invited. You know, I think that there was an off-the-cuff mention made, if anybody would ever like to go meet the person that's editing these things. I was like, that would be me, please. I was a student above the traditional age, so I didn't have anything better to do. And went and chatted with Dan. I think we probably had lunch or something like that. And I was like, you got any projects you need any help with? And somebody had come to him with a potential project, but I don't think they had much of a budget and they didn't really have an idea what they wanted to do. And he was like, you could work on this, Houston, if you wanted to. And I ended up doing a completely ham-fisted documentary of dismantling of some old, like deconstruction of some old houses in downtown Gainesville, kind of documenting the process and how they were retaining any materials that could still be reused and things like that. But it was a great opportunity for me because the stakes were kind of low. Like there was no, I don't want to say there were no expectations, but there was certainly no instruction given. They were just like, will you come document this? So I spent a week or 10 days, hours and hours. I generated so much material that was just, you know, most of it unusable. But I feel like you have to do that. If you're in production or if you're any creative process, you have to go through, you have to do your 10,000 hours, and much of which is going to be garbage. And then you look for the glitter in the garbage there. You look for the little moments there.
I always describe it as like the next project's the next best one you've ever done.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, this one's going to be bad compared to the next couple.
And you have to wade through that. And one thing I love about what we do, I know I'm kind of getting off topic here, is that every project, I feel like I come away learning something new. I've never mastered everything. And that's exhilarating. And you can either ignore that fact, you can reflect on your past work and go, okay, that was fun or good or whatever. Now, what could we do to make it better? Which is probably annoying to the students in the room here, where we're always saying, okay, if you were to do this same project again, what would you do differently? And there's a reason. It's because that's a question we're constantly asking ourselves as professionals as well.
So now you've done a first edit with Dan for those houses.
Sure.
What's next?
And Dan was at the time, he was producing a piece for UAA. I think it was called Gator Tales or something at the time that I think has been reabsorbed into or whatever the equivalent of that was. This is many years ago.
Is that with Robin Saran?
Yes. Robin helped with that.
We did her. She was like a Night Talks guest this last semester.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah.
Telling us all about the original Gator Tales.
And we would have Robin voiced some of the other sort of like corporate pieces that we'd done. We'd have her do the voice work. And when there was no budget for that, I would do the voice work. I would sit in my office and do the voice work.
That's where that voice came from.
Yes. You've heard this on many local commercials and things like that. A lot of variety. Big projects, small projects, long-term, short-term things.
Yoga videos.
We did some yoga videos, I think. Butterfly Pilates.
Butterfly Pilates.
Right, because Dan's wife, with the building that eventually they purchased and was Digital Lighthouse, was half Digital Lighthouse and half Butterfly Pilates.
That always the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, the light attracts the butterflies.
It's maybe moth Pilates, maybe. Yeah.
I'm on standby.
Okay.
So while working at Digital Lighthouse Productions in 2009, you started adjuncting at UF.
Yes.
What classes did you teach at that point, and what impelled you to come back to academia, other than you never leaving and wanting to always get more degrees?
Well, kind of true. I think that the first thing I taught was Fundamentals of Production Lab. So any of the students here that have taken Fundamentals of Production, I know that you all have, the lab, whoever your lab instructor was, that was me back in 2009, and I was still learning the ropes of how everything worked around here. Professor Sorrell was a professor of the lecture, so I was teaching his course, his labs. And I also had created sort of a short course in editing. We started with Final Cut Pro and then we moved to Premiere Pro, but it was like a night class that you could take for 5 weeks and sort of intensive to get students up and running with the editing software. And I think that's pretty much what I did as an adjunct.
By the end of 2013, you left Digital Lighthouse Productions, starting Houston Wells Productions. What inspired you to set out on your own?
Well, that I didn't really leave Digital Lighthouse. Dan just retired. Dan was ready to do something else. And so he closed the doors on Digital Lighthouse, and I just kept my office, and they kindly let me, rent an office in their space, and I just became Houston Wells Productions. And not much long after that, a position opened up, a faculty position at the university. So I applied to that and was hired. So the amount of time when I was Houston Wells Productions independent, producer, and then hired at the university was a very short period of time. And Houston Wells Productions still exists, but mostly I work with sort of like legacy clients, people that I'd done work with before, sort of updating old projects and things like that.
So as you mentioned, in 2014, you joined the CJC full-time as lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
What did attaining this role mean to you, especially since you had been a student in the doc program?
That's a powerful question. I really feel home here at the CJC because I was here as a student. And then I turned around and was here, a few years later as an adjunct. I never completely was disconnected from the college. I lived locally. I did production locally. One of my, Doc Institute professors, Churchill Roberts, was, a friend of mine over the time that I wasn't even working here. So we would, see each other from time to time. And then getting hired on as an adjunct just for, just one day a week in 2009, and then hired on full time. I have never really been a part since about 2099 when I came here as a grad student. And I've like worked at the radio station some during my grad program. And so I had like an a late night radio program and stuff that I hosted. So there's so many parts of this physical space that are a big part of my personal history. I don't even know if I'm addressing your question or not, but like I love being here. I come here early in the morning and watch the sun streaming down through the atrium and just kind of think back. It's different being here as an instructor, but you still have those memories of being here as a student. I have a memory back when I was studying zoology, and I worked at the Orange and Brew over at the Wright Union, which was a completely different location, completely different. It was a sandwich, sort of like a, you know, it was a little scruffier than what they have now. I don't know what it's called. Is it still called the Orange and Brew or whatever they call it now?
Like the Student Union?
The Brew. Yeah, in the, there's like a restaurant in there.
I think that's the Cabo Mexican
place. It's the Cabo Mexican place. So it's sort of evolved over time. Anyway, I was at work there and somebody said that I was working with, they said, oh, I got to go. I said, why do you have to leave? He's like, I got to go run camera for the Channel 5 news tonight. And this is when I had no association with the CJC. And I remember in that moment thinking to myself, that's like the coolest thing I've ever heard. Like I am so, and it, I should have, if I look back, I'm like, I should have like gone, run, not walked to go change my major. Cause I was like, oh my gosh, you are doing what I would dream about doing. And we know now that running camera for the 5 o'clock news is not as glamorous. It's awesome. It's part of the awesome. But in my mind, I was like, you've just blown my mind. So I really, even back then, there was a pull towards, you know, working in this industry.
What has it been like balancing your time at the university with freelance work and family? Cause you had legacy clients,
mm-hmm.
but also the 40 hours of instruction, 40 plus,
mm-hmm.
And then obviously home life. How do you balance all those things?
Poorly.
like the rest of us.
Yes, exactly. I can tell you that all of my children have appeared in like local commercials and things like that. There's a certain point where they say, no more, Dad, we're done. We don't want to be in one of these, you know, lawyer ads or something like that. I am lucky in that I enjoy what I do, and it's not just the production side that I enjoy. I like the teaching side too. I love, you know, interacting with the students. And so I do not come home at the end of a long day, you know, with this hangdog look on my face, slinging my, you know, briefcase against the wall, you know, cussing my boss or something like that. I'm like, I'm energized. I'm exhausted, but also energized by the experience. So I feel like that has probably, I mean, I don't know what the correct answer is in work-life balance. You know, when somebody figures it out, let me know. But that's it. So, and then it's a little tricky doing production work and not having that get in the, I mean, my first job is being a, you know, a lecturer. So I do a lot of stuff on the summertime. I'll tell clients, they'll say, can we do this? And I go, talk to me in like late May, early June. And that's when a lot of that gets done.
Classic. So we also know that you like to act.
Who's talking?
Hi, this is your good friend Paola. Checking back in. We know that you like to act in student projects from time to time, having graced the silver screen with your presence on My Short Films before.
Mm-hmm.
When you participate in these films, who do you think benefits more, you or the student?
The student. It's a nightmare for me. I really dislike it. No. Are you kidding? It's a blast to get to see. It is so exhilarating to see students bring together the skills and the creativity and the inspiration. And I know that so many of you bring to the table just brilliance and cleverness. Like you walk in the door with that, and then you have to find a way to make that mesh with sort of the technical know-how, which can sometimes sort of get in the way of the creative side of things. And then when you get to a point where you have a good enough grasp on the technical side of things that you can use that as just a conduit for your creativity, that's wonderful. I mean, that's one of the coolest things you get to experience, you know, as a teacher. So,
and you get to watch that deliver a line and then go back to watching them work and cook and be creative.
Mm-hmm. And then they've got like a, you know, a crafts services table or something like that, you know. And you get treated. It is much, much easier to be, with notable exceptions, I'm sure, it's much easier to be an actor than it is to be on the production side of things, because you just sit around and then deliver your one line. And usually if it's me, it's some goofball. Oh, this is a, you know, 75-year-old doddering fool or something like that. And I'm like, I'm in.
Do you have any feedback on student films and craft services and any recommendations?
You know what? I'm just happy to be there. I'm not, you know, I'll eat the Nutri-Grain bar and the and the Capri Sun or whatever, and I won't complain about it, because it's basically my diet if I'm left alone for any length of time. It's
and we'll
all
never
very
have
processed
fruit
food.
On set. Never, ever. It'll just be a mega packs of chips.
You don't have fruit on set?
There's never fruit on set.
Okay. Well, let me tell you.
There should be.
Red Delicious apples. I'm going to go on the record here. There's no reason why those should even exist anymore. They are red, but they're not delicious. They're you need Gala, you need Honeycrisp, Cosmic Crisp. Yep.
Donovan cutting back in here. So the college offers many study abroad opportunities, and as somebody who has been on many of the CJC summer abroad trips, how would you say that these trips impact the students?
The study abroad program, I have done, let me make sure I'm, yeah, so this will be the fourth summer that I've participated in the study abroad program. And I was kind of blown away from the start that simply the experience, I mean, there's an academic side to it. Absolutely. There'd be no point if there were not. I mean, the students take classes. But the experience of travel, especially if a student has not traveled very much, and we have several students that this is, occasionally it's their first time on an airplane. For many, many of them, it's the first time there's been international travel. And it is just a mind-opening experience for so many reasons, obvious reasons. Oh, you're going to witness that a different culture, right? You go to a new place and people don't all act or think like you do. And that doesn't make it right or wrong, but it's sort of this mind-blowing thing for some students. What I think is maybe one of the biggest impacts it's had on me, and I think it probably impacts the students as well, is you land in Florence, Italy, or London, or wherever, and you realize this was quite easy to get. There's no magic to going to Europe or, you know, whatever case, South America or anything like that. It's just a matter of doing it. It's sort of a matter of will. Now, it's easy for me to say because it's also a matter of you have to write a check for that. You know, you got to pay for that. I'm dating myself saying write a check. But, you know, I understand that that's absolutely can be an obstacle. But once you get past that obstacle, it's a simple and then once you go to one place and experience and go, this is amazing, then the floodgates are open. And then you're like, I want to be a student of the globe, a citizen of the world. And I've made it's speaking of interacting with students in the classroom, interacting with students on a study abroad program is a whole next level because you are meeting challenges together, right? And that's you're experiencing new things together, having fun. Like I said, there's challenges. There's periods of boredom and stuff where you're waiting, you know, 4 hours for, you know, the next flight and things like that. So you get to experience the world differently than you do in the classroom.
Where have you been on these different trips? Which countries?
The first year I went to Barcelona and we did a little time in Madrid in Spain. And then the following year we went to Florence, Italy and Rome, some of that. The year after that, last summer, we were in London and went to Edinburgh, Scotland for a long weekend. And then we flew to Athens for like one overnight and then to the island of Crete for, I think, 10 days maybe. I may have that maybe more like a week. So that was a really interesting dichotomy of London and Crete. But I wouldn't have changed that at all. You know, on paper, you say, well, this is an odd combination. And then you go experience and go, that was so – it's two very different experiences. Each, you know, rich in their own way.
Excellent. No. You're the next question.
Oh, sorry. Hey, it's your good friend Paolo again. We here at WFT heard rumblings about your footage of the elusive pocket gopher. Oh. Now, I'm sure you get asked this all the time.
All the time. You have no idea. I can't believe this is like the sixth time today somebody's asked me about the pocket gopher footage.
Can you walk us through the process of getting that footage? Was it like trap cameras? Patience.
No, keep going. Keep guessing. And I'll tell you, I'll nod silently.
Drone.
This is really good for podcast.
Were you wearing like a suit to blend in with the agriculture?
I was wearing a pocket gopher suit.
Exactly.
And I was attacked. It was body cam. Thank God I had the GoPro on. I would never have been able to. The inquest with the police was that really helped. So I was out at Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery. I don't know if you are familiar with Prairie Creek.
Assume we're not. Tell us what that is.
Okay, well, Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is a wonderful organization. It's a plot of land. It's actually part of the Prairie Creek Conservation area. I should know this better. I'm embarrassed that I can't just roll this out. But it's a 90-acre parcel of land and a Prairie Creek Preserve is what I'm thinking of. which is on the kind of the east side of Gainesville, and it's an area that's owned and managed by the Alachua Conservation Trust. And so Prairie Creek Conservation Cemetery is a cemetery where all the graves are, they're hand dug and the burials are done by hand. We have a meadow area and there's sort of a forested area. There's no embalming. There's no big burial chambers or anything like that. It's all, a lot of the burials are done with shrouds or like a wicker casket, things like that. The idea is that we're not only preserving the land, but we're also restoring the land to sort of its original. And I say we, I'm on the board of directors. I was a longtime volunteer there, and now I'm part of the board of directors. So I was out there doing what I do, which is when I'm bored, I take my video camera and my still camera out, and I like to go take pictures of nature. And I was shooting some promotional stuff for the cemetery. And I was out there by myself in the let me paint the picture for you.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what time of day it was. I think it was like early evening. And I heard some noise behind me. And that makes it sound scary. It was just sort of like this, the sound of dirt moving behind me. And I turned around and there was a little gopher mound, which is not uncommon to see a gopher mound out in the field. But to see one that was actively being created by a gopher was kind of a new thing. So I very quietly put the 70 to 200 lens on my camera and turned around and shot some video of this gopher who was just busily, you know, clearing out this burrow, and ended up, and I just was like, oh, well, that was cool. Wow. I shot some footage of this little guy. So I had some students that were working on a project and they were working alongside another group of students who were doing a research piece about pocket gophers and how they are possibly the only other animals or mammals that farm. And it was whatever. You can look it up and read it. I'm not going to go into the details here. But so they used that footage. I said, I have some footage here you guys can use. They incorporated it in the piece. And then the piece got picked up by the university and got distributed to whoever wants, you know, that sort of information about research that's going on at the university. And the bit that folks wanted was, boy, that's amazing that you have that footage of the pocket gopher. Can we get our hands on that footage? So it ended up showing up. I think the New York Times did a piece that used a still from it. There was like Scientific American, I want to say National Geographic, like some of their online stuff. So that was kind of exciting. And that some work that I did out on the east side of Gainesville showed up on these various media outlets.
Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
The zoology degree came into handy.
You know, I tell my students I never regret anything that I study, you know, even if you shift gears. And I really believe that, like you guys are taking production classes and things like that. If you go off and your career path takes you in a different direction, you're still going to have this body of knowledge and this practice that you are absolutely going to apply. And people say, oh, well, you wasted your zoology degree. And nobody really says that to me. But people say, oh, you really shifted gears there. And I say, yeah, but I use that information all the time. And it's just part of what I'm passionate about. When I'm bored, I tell my students this too. I'm like, you know, I'm feeling a little low when I'm just feeling out of it or something. I grab my camera and I just go out and I go to Payne's Prairie or I go out to the woods and something like that. And just the process of creating makes you creative, and the process of being creative kind of lifts your spirits a little bit.
I'm Glenn Richards from WUFT Amplified. If you're like me, you appreciate how special the local music scene is here in North Central Florida, featuring indie rock, hip hop, bluegrass, so much more. WUFT Amplified is Florida's music series, filmed right here in Weimar Hall. This show rocks, guys, seriously. And you might not realize that WUFT Amplified is produced entirely by UFCJC staff and students. To watch past episodes and discover your new favorite bands, check out WUFT.org/amplified.
So, given that your footage of the pocket gopher was a very chance thing, how much of a role would you say that spontaneity and right place, right time play in creating documentaries or any type of unscripted story?
So, that's an interesting question. because you have to be in the right place at the right time, even through luck, requires you have to go out and be in a place at a time. Now, it's not always going to work out for you, but you have to get out into the world. And if we're talking about unscripted stuff, if we're talking about documentary, I tell my doc students, and if any of them are listening to this, they'll laugh because they've heard this from me before. You have to go talk to strangers. You have to be interested. And I don't even mean interested in specific things. Just put your antenna up. Ask questions. Walk around in places that you normally would drive through. Go to places you normally would not go and ask yourself questions about what you see, and who would be a good person that you could talk to about that. And that's how so many of the student projects that arrive, you know, that they come up with are just from them going and saying, hey, I found out that X exists in Gainesville, or there's somebody that did this, or do you know that there's this event that happens? And then you have to go to be right place, right time. Okay, go talk to somebody. Go develop a relationship with somebody that knows about that. And it is a time-consuming, sometimes, you know, slow, painful process, but that's how you insert yourself, insinuate yourself into some other situation. If you want to tell somebody's story, you can't do it from the outside. You got to dig in there, and if you expect people to trust you with their story, you've got to give them a reason to trust you. And so all of this kind of ties back to your question about spontaneity. It's, yes, it's spontaneous, but it's by design. You go put yourself in that position.
Houston, is there any one documentary that you've seen that you think everyone should watch? What would that be if you had to point to one or two?
There are several docs that I really love. And it's, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but I don't watch a whole lot of doc. I don't watch a whole lot of anything. But it's not to say I don't. I'm not one of those people who's like, I don't have a television. it's just, and I don't know if I don't watch a lot of docs because I'm afraid I'm just going to get demoralized and go, I'll never make something that good. But there are several that just really have kind of touched my heart. I have a friend that was the supervising editor for a documentary that won the Academy Award several years ago. I want to say 2013, maybe. And I say friend. It's an acquaintance from long ago. We haven't communicated in a while, but I'd say we're still friends. Called 20 Feet from Stardom, which was fantastic because it was such a wonderful treatment of, like, the subject matter is right there. It's right there. It's about backup singers for famous performers and this amazing amount of talent that is sort of relegated to not the spotlight. And that's what
sometimes
you're
like, oh, the backup singer is more talented than the primary singer.
And this is this tells the story of specific performers, and you do realize you're like, oh my gosh, you're in the presence of amazing talent, but you're not paying attention to them. And they know they're talented, and that's part of the fun, too, is because they have egos just like everybody else does. So that's one that I would recommend. There's another one that really kind of changed, just flipped my brain over. It's called Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, Errol Morris, who's a very well-known documentarian, where he took basically four different character studies and then just shuffled them like a deck of cards. And it's a wonderful example of how your viewer is going to create meaning. No matter what they're looking at and hearing, our brains can't help but make something out of that. And so this film really sort of challenges that and proves that point. And then if there's one more doc that just blew me away, and it's not because it was produced, it's not perfect, right? It's just sort of a standard documentary. It's called How to Die in Oregon, and it addresses like assisted suicide. So I heard somebody say recently, if it's not interesting, it better be important. And if you have both of those things, great, but it better be interesting or it better be important. And that felt like one that was important, and by extension, interesting. So those are some. Put them on your Netflix watch list or whatever we do these days.
Put it on my Letterboxd. Mm-hmm. 20 Feet from Stardom. That's how it feels to be an assistant podcast host. So speaking of stand-up comedy,
Were we?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
We know that you do stand-up comedy here in Gainesville. Are you regularly workshopping your jokes in class or on shoots? Or how do you find that you get your material?
This is like a whole other conversation. I feel like...
Segues, right?
Yeah. Like, I don't... I find that I'm constantly writing, but I don't really workshop stuff because it's pretty obvious when you're trying to do that. You do stand-up sometimes?
I do. Uh-huh. I dabble.
Yeah. So...
What's the deal with the bathrooms in Weimar? They're always wet.
And you... Never mind.
I'm not funny.
It's true.
There's this temptation. Because if you write something, if you come up with something, you want to perform, like it wants to be performed, but you never, ever want to get called out by somebody going, is that a joke that you wrote? Like, that's terrible.
I think all jokes are like jokes that you write. Just depends on like how quick you deliver them.
Well,
it depends on if you have to explain it afterwards.
So there's a difference there, though. There's situational humor where you're just commenting on the moment, and then there are stand-up jokes, right? Monologue jokes, and they're different. And when you write something, you're very focused on like the structure of it, and then you know, like the delivery and the structure.
The 3 beats.
And I mean, sure, if you want to be cliched,
the game.
I go with the 1 beat. Really, you just get more jokes per minute.
The Mitch Hedberg style,
exactly. Yeah, I was just thinking about Mitch Hedberg this morning.
He's great.
On the drive-in, yeah.
He's so funny.
I have an infestation of koalas, cutest infestation ever.
Right.
I like having rice when I want 1 million of something.
too many. I was thinking about his joke about how bananas are like stoplights or different than stoplights.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about while I was on the drive this morning. So
that's how
obsessive I am about stand-up comedy is I was thinking about Mitch Hedberg. This morning on the drive-in.
Who doesn't think about Mitch Hedberg a couple times a day?
It's kind of true.
You know, Houston, since you do create content and you think about the audience and how they interpret the work, how is that similar and different to creating comedy?
I think that for stand-up, it is so important to be very concise. I'm trying to think of there's a word I'm thinking of and I can't come up with it, but,
restraint.
It's not even that. It's like cutting out everything that you don't need.
Yes.
What is the functional unit of that joke? Mm-hmm. And part of that is how much information does the audience need so they can contextualize where you're going? And then how do you deliver the punchline and like what's the strongest way to end it? And then if you decide you want to do an act out or something like that, how is that, you know, I don't know. Paula, you look like you have a thought.
I always do. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with Delirious by Eddie Murphy?
Yes.
The stand-up special?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
Eddie Murphy, is he new?
He's this underground comic.
Mm-hmm.
He was really big in the 80s.
Delirious was a second big one that he did, right?
I that's the one where he's wearing kind of like the Michael Jackson, like red is leather.
Oh, it's red?
Yeah, it's like the red leather.
Then
like
what's the
thriller.
Purple? Where he's wearing the purple suit?
I don't know.
Sorry. Okay.
I'm a little bit of a faker.
Mm-hmm.
But he has this like 15 to 20 minute long bit that is one of the funniest things ever, which I'm saying this because this kind of goes against the like succinct, because they're like a Mitch Hedberg style where it's just like basically like popsicle kind of style jokes where it's like set a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like kind of more storytelling and comedy. And I think there's a really interesting distinction. So this like 20 minute bit where he's talking about like his family reunion and his like aunt with the mustache and the dog and his dad. Do you know what like bit I'm talking about?
Yes.
And it's like, spoiler alert, even though this came out 40 years ago, the whole thing is at the end, he's calling his like aunt like a Bigfoot. And like, that's like the big punchline. And it's hilarious. And she falls down the stairs and she's falling down the stairs for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those things where it's like the embellishment of like the story and like, this is a 20-minute long story that could very easily be like summed up in like 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's 20 minutes long and you're world building and you get to know all these characters and it feels like someone's telling you a story. It's, I don't know. It's just a different way to do it. And I think it's cool.
It's, it's definitely a different style. And what's interesting, if you transcribe something like that, you'll see that there are punch, like there are laugh lines in there. But so much of that, I mean, if you're talking about Eddie Murphy, especially young Eddie Murphy, forget about that. I mean, it's just so much. I think about like Richard Pryor or something where they're just inhabiting these characters that are so, so funny and so absurd, but still recognizable. And Yeah, that is not, I do not have whatever that, can you believe that I do not have the charisma of Eddie, of a young Eddie Murphy? I know people.
But you do have like a Jim Carrey essence to you.
Thank you. You've That's got a nice. Goofy, goggly-eyed, weird, bad posture. Is this what I'm, stop me at like, any point.
Like a, yeah. like a Jim mask. Carrey mixed with like a David Byrne. I would say is where
I'll
you're
take
at.
That. Speaking of David Byrne, he and I share the same birthday. He's older than I am, not the same birth date, but we're both May 14.
Do you guys celebrate together?
I wish. I keep reaching out to him, but he won't respond.
One day.
But, of course, the Talking Heads concert film Stop Making Sense is featured heavily, largely in 20 Feet from Stardom. And, a lot of talent on that stage. So you were saying Jim Carrey, David Byrne. I'll take it. I'll take the David Byrne reference, please, any day of the week. As far as like structuring, I love to write. I like to perform, but it's a lot of work for me to prepare to get up and because I have to. This sounds so stupid. I'm too lazy. I don't want to memorize the jokes. And you can't like read them off of a card. I mean, that's bad.
I think you can.
Well, people do. I don't mean that. I don't want to do that, okay. Right? But it's one reason why I don't perform as much as I probably should, because the only way to get better is to do the stuff. And also, you'll write stuff, and you know this. You'll write things, and you'll think to yourself, oh, this is really good, or this isn't so good. And then the audience will tell you completely different than what you thought. Or one audience will respond one way, and so another audience will respond a different way. And you have to just sort of plug away at it. And I don't know if I have thick enough skin to do that. Also, things like open mic comedy night, they're late. I'm an old man. I got to get up early and go to work. You know what I mean?
They're also always in the middle of the week.
Yeah, yeah.
The Vecinas one.
Get up early to see the sunrise beaming through the Weimar atrium.
Much like Batman looking over Gotham City.
It's true. When does Batman sleep, right?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. That's why he's got the cowl. It covers the dark eyes.
We'll keep our eyes peeled for the Houston Wells WFT comedy special coming up sometime in 2026.
We'll do a Def Jam comedy special with Houston Wells.
If I can remember like 5 minutes worth of bits, I'm so thrilled. I'm like, oh, I made it.
Would you ever do like sketch comedy as opposed to stand-up?
I have not really done that before. I'm interested.
It's like, a lot of fun. And it's interesting because it's ensemble as opposed to like standalone.
Mm-hmm.
So you're playing off of people. And it's also like, because I know that you know about like Generation Sketch Comedy here at UF, which I am a part of for those listening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
You know I'm always in the audience, right?
You're always in the audience, but you're always gone before the show's over. So
I'm
never,
not gone when the show... What are you talking about? I'm always there.
I've got to go to bed.
No, because I don't want to steal you. You guys have just put on a show and you want to hang and everything like that.
I always look for you at the... I've done three shows. Never seen you at the end of the show. I always look.
Well... I'm there.
Much like the elusive pocket gopher, you're gone.
He's gone, but there are flowers left for the cast and crew. So connect the dots.
But sketch comedy, I think there's a memorization aspect, which I guess if...
Mm-hmm.
But it's also kind of like how in stand-up, everything has to kind of like stand alone. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more like nothing has to make sense in a sketch. Like it can end a little bit ridiculous. And there's a lot more absolvement of maybe
and
norms.
With stand-up, you don't get the element of interacting with somebody else. And that's part of the flying by the seat of your pants appeal to it. And you get all the blame and all the glory.
It's high risk, high reward.
So then what's your view on crowd work? Because, I mean, my TikTok is filled with comedians just doing crowd work right now.
And do you know why?
I don't.
Because they don't want to burn their material.
That makes sense.
Right. So
let's make fun of Blue Shirt.
Exactly. And so that's something that you can show and then you don't have to worry about, you know, somebody knowing your joke the next time you go perform in, you know, wherever, Peoria. I don't know. Where are we going with that? I feel like we were on something. Sketch.
Yeah. No, I was just asking if you're interested. I don't even know if there are like sketch comedy groups like beyond just like in Gainesville.
For old people? Is that what you're trying to not say?
For non-students?
Students above the traditional age. I'm a student of the world.
For the forever learners.
Uh-huh.
For the forever learners.
I'm the forever forgetter is what I am. I have done some, I don't know if this was on your list there, but I've done some acting at the like the Crosstown Repertory Theater and the Gainesville Community Playhouse. So it's a completely different, I remember the first time I did a play at the Community Playhouse. And I remember thinking to myself, people would ask me, they'd go, wow, it seems hard. You got to learn all these lines and stuff. And I said, I didn't have to write any of this. Are you kidding me? This is so easy. You just, somebody else puts a page in front of you, and then you have a lot of time to memorize it, and you interact with other people, and yeah, so that was, that's less challenging than the stand-up thing.
So Houston, kind of circling back to academia, what courses are you teaching right now?
I teach Fundamentals of Production, which is a lecture and lab course. All the production students have to take that, so my apologies in advance if you have that on your schedule for next semester. And then I teach an EFP2 course, sort of a mid-level class that I call Documentary Prep. So it's sort of a skills-based nonfiction storytelling class to prepare you for other longer-form work. And then I teach a senior workshop, a capstone class called Documentary Production, where we make documentaries from day one. Yes.
Tell us about that course and what kind of projects students can take on if they wanted to enroll.
Absolutely. So it's just a semester, which is just about enough time to make a documentary. So we try to get started very, very early. I don't dictate what the topics are going to be about. I let the students come up with several ideas. And like I said, I say, go talk to people you don't know. Go walk around and find, if there are things that you can ask questions about, those are things that you can probably pursue a documentary about. A lot of times after week one or week two, we've got a series of just kernels of topics that then the small groups decide to pursue. And I also warn them, I say the story that you think you're going to tell, the beginning of the semester and the story you end up telling are not going to be the same thing. They'll be related, but they're not going to be the same. It can be a little anxiety inducing sometimes, especially early on. But I mean, I feel like production is like that sometimes, where you just have to have faith that I'm going to go through the process and I will, and at a certain point it will begin to congeal for me. And I think that maybe that's part of the value of this course, is that we're very forgiving of ourselves. We embrace the imperfection of the process, knowing that we're going to create something and hopefully something we're proud of at the end of the semester.
Excellent. What advice do you have for aspiring filmmakers and documentarians? I mean, I think you touched on a lot of small kernels,
yes.
But what's the biggest takeaway that you would want them to know?
For aspiring documentarians, yeah, I'm going to fall back on this idea of just be curious and talk to create relationships. And that's not just for documentary. That's for production. So much of this business is creating relationships with people, the people that you work with, the people that you are producing stories about. If you're doing it commercially, then working with clients and things like that. You have to, I think, unless you're very, very specialized in what you do, you have to like people. And you have to ask questions. You have to be curious about the world around you. And then if you find yourself in a period of time where, like, you're between jobs, or, you know, you finished one client job and it's another month or so before something else starts, there are always new things to be learning. There's always some skill sets that you can be practicing. And just go out and take your camera. Take your microphone. Forget the camera. Take a microphone and a digital recorder and just go listen to the world. That's exhilarating. And I've said it before, but the act of creating makes you creative. And if you sit at home and wait for that spark of creativity, it's not going to come. But if you go out there and put yourself in a place to be spontaneous, you'll be shocked at what comes from that.
What is your thought? I know there's a lot of technical equipment lust.
Mm-hmm.
What camera body? What gear?
Mm-hmm.
What's your stance on equipment? And is it more important what's right behind the camera, aka your brain? Like, where do you stand on obsessing over camera equipment?
So, and that's a perennial, perennial question. Is everybody wants to know especially young graduates and stuff. What should I buy?
Nikon, and, Sony, Canon,
exactly.
Blackmagic,
and
Nokia,
Olympus. the real truth is sometimes the gear does matter. Okay, it doesn't play as huge a role as you might think, but everybody that's been doing this for a while knows that a good lens is wonderful. And a cheap lens is frustrating and will make you not like what you're doing. So there's kind of a balance point between the gear and the creative person. But I would rather spend less money on last year's camera model and use that extra money to buy a decent microphone and maybe a decent prime lens or something like that. But what's really going to matter, what is a wonderful feeling is to take some affordable production gear and go use it and use it and use it until it stops working or until you reach the edges of its ability. And then you're like, now I've sort of evolved to the point where I recognize I need something. I need a wider lens or a faster lens or a better microphone or something like that. But all of this is predicated on you just going out and doing this thing that is fun. And people want to do what you are doing. If you're working in production, there's a lot of competition because, well, it's a lot of work, but it's also very rewarding and a lot of fun. I don't know if I've really addressed your question. One of the tools that you have at your disposal is one is your brain, your creative mind, and one is your body and moving, using that to move the camera through space. And I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, it's this combination of things. And if you kind of embrace this, and it's a little woo-woo. I mean, it's a little bit out there, but if you let yourself just sort of be enraptured by the process, even if you're not working for a client, you are just creating something. And that's like magic, right? That's something that we humans can do. And I couldn't ask for anything cooler than that.
It's the wizard, not the wand.
How profound.
Yes. The lens chooses the photographer, Harry.
I have another addendum question for you. What would you say is the most challenging production you've ever been a part of, and how'd you kind of push through?
Oh, gosh. I don't know that I'm going to have a great answer for that, because different projects are challenging in different ways.
Well, that's part of it, too, is you're not always just doing a narrative or a documentary. Mm-hmm. You're doing a corporate video, and that uses different skills.
Mm-hmm. But most challenging, I've done some field work down in the Everglades, where I just remember one day, and this is a boring answer because it was like physically challenging. I don't know how hot it was. 100% humidity, 100% mosquitoes, where there wasn't a water molecule. There was a little animal buzzing around, and it was just a zillion degrees. And the person that was producing the shoot was unhappy with like every take. And at a certain point, you just have to look around at your talent and your crew and go, we've gotten what we're going to get. Obviously, you want to work towards excellence. But I just remember thinking, this is one of those moments where maybe this isn't so fun. I'm ready to go, you know, get out of this madness. That is a nice thing about working, you know, independently, is that you get to pick what you pursue. Somebody else can go do that work. I don't need to be the one to do that. There's going to be some other things that I'm interested in, and that I can. There's enough work. I don't want to say there's enough work to go around, but there kind of is. There are people that need your skills, and so you get to sort of choose who you work with and for.
Another addendum, but I think it fits actually right behind this question. A lot of students in our college are being trained to work for the next Gray and Tegna and big stations, Hearst. What value do you think you would say the freelance end of things is, and going to business for yourself, Houston Wells Production, for instance, versus feeling like you have to go into business with an organization or a company that already is in the space?
Right. Well, I can tell you the other side of that coin is, and somebody I worked with years and years ago said, I wake up every day unemployed. When you are working freelance, that's you go from job to job. So it's feast or famine. But you also, the whole world is in front of you, and you're not necessarily answering to somebody else. And if you have a good relationship with the client, then hopefully that's a creative relationship. Many, many times I've had somebody come to me and say, we think we need a video. And that's like the beginning of the conversation. They don't come in and say, we need this video that expresses this much, and here's our script, and here's our talent. And I really relish that moment because I say, okay, let's team up. Let's put our creative brains together and figure out a way to communicate not just your message, but to have your viewer respond in the way that you want them to respond. I mean, that's like a creative problem solving right there. And then how can we apply the equipment and the skills that we have to move in that direction. So I don't think that you really get that if you're, you know, entry level job at a big corporate space.
Yeah. But, you know, editing for a news station and you're kind of just doing whatever they hand down to you. Mm-hmm. Any other follow-up questions from the team?
What is kind of your personal limit in terms of the types of spicy food that you think you can handle?
Do we have 10 chicken wings out here? I can do better than who's the guy that bailed out after like two wings? Who was that guy?
Was that Donovan?
No. Oh, really? Oh, you're no, asking because of the commercial. Show. Yeah. They're on Hot Ones or whatever.
You know, I met Sean Evans.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I met him at Sunday.
Why would I know that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I just recently got the follow back on Instagram. If you followed me in January, you would have seen I met him.
Oh, nice.
It was crazy.
Nice,
I didn't say a thing about it.
I did see a thing where like Bill Murray was like, this is tasty on like the hottest ones.
Yeah, didn't react.
Yeah.
I think he's so old that his like nerve endings aren't there anymore.
He's probably reacting right now. It's like it took a while for the neurons
just
to.
Just kicked in.
Yeah. No, Donovan, very famously, I don't know if you guys know this or not, portrayed me at the end of semester project where they were having a. That was so funny.
Yeah, I directed that shoot.
Where
it was my idea.
Just the look on, when they were like, we're not going to put the real hot sauce on there until the actual shoot. And you guys were just, who was opposite you? Who was playing?
Rowan. Rowan was playing Sean Evans.
Oh my gosh. And then you guys took a bite of that. Like you're just, you know, kings of the world. And then you took a bite and both of y'all had like tears streaming on your eyes and your face.
Fun fact that I found out after was that they were scheming at first to just put, like, eat the hottest one first. For those who don't know, at the end of Fundamentals, you have to do a live studio show, and you have one like mulligan, but you're basically when you're going, you're going. So I sniffed them out before we went for actual tape, and I told them, do not do that, because then you'll be dying the entire time, and I will fail this assignment because you're my actors.
We were gonna pull our own bit and just do the bomb first,
and I would not have been friends with them anymore.
Good for you. You chose wisely. You should never. When you're working with a team, when you're working with a crew, that's actually a real thing that you have to sort of figure out when you're working on a crew is like what level of foolishness is okay. Because at the end of the day, you better get the shot. At the end of the day, you got to walk away with the proper footage so that the editor can have something to work with. And people get a little bit punchy at the end of the day. So you have to kind of dial that back. So I'm grateful that you did not undermine Paola's.
I would have been guns a-blazing in Studio One.
But back to the question, what's your tolerance?
Not very hot. Yeah, I mean, I like spicy stuff, but I'm kind of like, if there's a medium, I'll go medium, unless it's like an Indian restaurant or something, and then I'm like, half a pepper, please, whatever the smallest one is.
Do you go to Zaxby's and order the wimpy sauce?
I don't. I don't go to Zaxby's.
You know, one thing we didn't talk about is the doc class and how some of those projects have gone on to win awards, go to festivals,
sure,
broadcast.
Mm-hmm. So that's one great thing about working with the capstone course in documentary film production is these students are producing content that is ready to be seen by the world. It's not just practice stuff. These are actually, you know, short docs. Some of them go on to be recognized in film competitions. We've had some being recognized by the Broadcast Education Association Festival of Media Arts, and which is all strictly student work. So we submit those. But we're lucky enough to have WUFT TV here in Weimar Hall. So several of our docs, well, I say several, I think maybe a couple, hopefully more to come. We're able to screen those and package those with a little Q&A session to sort of bulk out the time to a half hour unit. And so it does a couple of things. It's exhilarating for the students to have their work seen by an audience. And everybody in here knows it changes not just the level of effort that you put into, but the experience of creating the film is one thing. The experience of experiencing the film with an audience is a whole other thing. And so being able to broadcast some of these has been just wonderful for the students and also wonderful for me. I love to be able to say I was able to be a part of that. I was able to guide them. And this is all student work. But to sort of be in the room where it happens when they're creating those is really fantastic. Well, thank you so much for having me here on the podcast. What a delight it is to spend time in the studio with you guys. Let's do this again real soon sometime.
Thanks, Houston. We enjoy our time.
Same time next week.
Thank you. done.
Done.
The Communicator Podcast is a production of UF's College of Journalism and Communications. This episode was produced by Donovan Gast and Paola Perez. Thanks to our guest, Houston Wells, hosted by Matt Abramson and featuring Donovan Gast and Paola Perez. Special thanks to WUFT. Go Gators!